Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm very proud to have as our guest today Nelson DeMille, and we're going to be discussing Mr. DeMille's new novel, which is titled Nightfall, published by Warner Books, which will be on bookshelves on November 22nd. And in this book, which is the third John Corey book, I've decided that a good way to start the conversation would be to talk about John Corey, because in the past, Mr. DeMille has had characters that have appeared in more than one book, but I wouldn't classify them necessarily as a series character. And I must say, I was delighted when I got the galleys and started reading Nightfall, that John Corey was back, because I find him a very refreshing breeze of wind in what has become a lot of the characters that people write about are tortured souls, and it seems like they just can't enjoy anything they do. And why don't we start out with Plum Island? When you started with John Corey, did you have any idea that he was going to become a series character?
No, Casey, I didn't. Most of my books, in fact, all my books were standalone novels, and John Corey was created in probably middle 1990s. There's a lot of controversy about the politically correct.
Mm-hmm.
I decided I needed a guy who was politically incorrect, and like a lot of New York City cops really are.
Yes.
And I created him for a particular book, and there was no sequel imagined. And if you read the book, there was no sequel promised at the end. But the fans respond to this guy, and the sales department at Warner said, loved the guy because we sold a lot of books. And most of the fan mail I had prior to that was about the novel. This was the first time I got a lot of fan mail about the character.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the guy, and men loved the guy. And when you can create a guy that men love and women love, you're on the right track.
Yeah, and my wife was very attracted to the character, and a lot of women I've talked to have been, and I think part of it is just his straightforwardness, and people are sick of just reading about everything being so politically correct. Three of the finest series that I think are being written today, I think James Lee Burke's Dave Robichaux, Michael Conley's Harry Bosch, and Lawrence Block's Matthew Scudder, I think they're all wonderful characters, but they seem to be tortured souls, and it seems like they can't enjoy a good glass of scotch, a cigarette, and some sex without waking up the next day and just having to go to the analyst about it.
Yeah, John Corey is definitely a throwback, and it's probably generational, although he's not that old. He's in his 40s, so I think he has a 60-year-old head like I do. I'm a different generation. So I gave this guy a lot of my own personality traits, and I enjoy a good scotch, and I still enjoy my cigarette. Although John Corey doesn't smoke, I drew the line there. You get more negative fan mail about your characters who smoke. So.
Yeah.
He's allowed to have sex. He's allowed to drink scotch. And
yeah.
A lot of flirt with women, but he can't smoke.
Yeah. You know, he reminded me of a little bit is Travis McGee from the John D. McDonald series.
Absolutely.
And Travis McGee was a guy who I felt truly cared about what was happening in Florida and the ruination of with the developers. And he always had McGee to bounce his ideas off of. And Travis McGee did not take advantage of women. He did not. He was not a cad. He was a very, very a very, very good man. And John Corey, I compare a little bit to Travis McGee, and I miss Travis McGee, because I think he was a very good man. I think John D. McDonald cared a lot about this country, as I think you do.
Yeah, we're seeing sometimes the best way to examine a culture and a country is through the eyes of a detective of all things. It's been done before, nothing new. And sometimes, you examine the culture through a murder case, and people who, how they respond to a murder, and then John Corey's ruminations. All the Corey books, Plum Island, Lion's Game, and Nightfall, all first person. He has a lot of time to ruminate, and he's talking to the audience. And the nice thing about Corey that I like is that he says one thing to people, he's a little sarcastic, but he's thinking something else all the time. And
yes.
Reminds me a little bit, too, of Columbo. And,
yes, exactly.
And in fact, in the first book, Plum Island, he does a Columbo routine purposely, and he calls it a Columbo routine, and he plays the idiot to a suspect. And yet, you know that deep down there, not deep down, but right under his skull is a really fine mind. A lot of people have commented on that the man is very, very clever.
Yes, and one of the things the references to the X-Files, I get a kick out of too, because he drives his wife Kate Mayfield crazy with these references.
Oh.
And do you get a lot of comments on that from your fans?
Yeah, I mean, all his little hang-ups and all his little asides, I think, can really speak to the reader. And it's not easy to flesh out a character and to make him sound real and be real. And but you know, when you put him in that milieu of New York City cop, and that's what he was in the first book, Plum Island. He was actually a cop on convalescent leave, had been wounded,
right?
Kind of off the books. But the second book, Lion's Game, he had joined the Federal Joint Terrorist Task Force. Although in my book I call it the Anti-Terrorist Task Force, to avoid problems with the real Joint Terrorist Task Force.
Sure.
So he's in this different culture of FBI and CIA people, and the FBI, of course, is very perfectly correct, and they're very much, to some extent, you know, the most of them are lawyers, and some of them are Ivy League, and John is totally different. He's a man who's gotten into this situation, and they consider him kind of a troglodyte. It's kind of fun because he's smarter than all of them put together, but they think he's a hard-drinking cop.
Yeah.
Hard-drinking cops in their own milieu are good characters, but this is a guy out of his milieu. He's now working for the FBI. I think it's kind of funny after a while.
Yeah, and it is. But really, when push comes to shove, it seems like they go to the New York Police Department detectives to get the work done.
No, these are the guys who do it for a living. And the FBI guys, I don't think anything away from the FBI. They're very well-trained and they're very educated, but they don't have the street smarts that an NYPD guy would have. This is why they hire them. What they hired him for is what they don't like him doing, because he's a bull. He's a bull in a china shop, and he gets the job done. They don't like how he's getting it done.
Yeah. Well, let's move on then to the Lions game, because I thought that the opening scene in the Lions game, I thought, was one of the most suspenseful opening scenes in a novel I've read in a long time, because you have this plane landing itself, and you have absolutely no idea what's going on inside the plane, because they've been out of contact with the towers for I believe it's over 2 hours. And I believe that in a prior to your writing career, that you used to do some investigative fraud for insurance companies. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, one of my first jobs out of the Army was an insurance investigator, and so I had a little bit of that background, and it was kind of interesting. It was kind of a job you could, you know, make a career out of, but maybe I wasn't that good at it.
Yeah, yeah. Did any of that ever have to do with aircraft? Because you know so much about, it seems like you know so much about the aircrafts.
No, I'll tell you where that comes from. My childhood friend, Tom Block, we grew up together since we were five, was a U.S. air pilot, and some of your listeners might know Tom Block as a frequent contributor and also an editor at Flying Magazine and a lot of other aviation magazines. Plus, Tom and I co-authored at Mayday together back in 1980, I believe it was.
Yeah, very good book.
And, you know, you read that, and that was, and Tom, of course, is not just a pilot, but he's also well-regarded, I guess we call him an expert, and he's been, you know, on some investigation committees about airline accidents and that type of thing. These are really great resources.
Oh, okay.
He's a writer and also very, very knowledgeable about airplanes, and every time I have an airplane scene, you know, I know where to go.
I gotcha. Now, the character Asad Khalil becomes very important in the Lions game, and one of the things that I loved, kind of a little homage you threw to the readers, is one of the trainers he has is Boris from the Charm School.
Right.
And something tells me we haven't seen the last of Asad Khalil.
Asad Khalil was a Libyan terrorist in the Lions game, and Boris was a KGB agent who... and yes, they will both appear again. Not the book I'm writing now, but the book after.
Okay.
Decided to take a break from John Corey for the next book, but the book after is the denouement with it's Corey and Khalil, you know, and their last battle, and Boris shows up again. A lot of the characters from Lion's Game will show up in this second book that I'm actually working on at the same time I'm working on the book I'm supposed to be writing now. So.
Yeah, I had a feeling that might be the case, because there's some. It seems like there's some things left undone with Khalil. So is the Lions game, is this being, I know you've sold the movie rights to it, is it in production yet, Nelson, or is it still in the planning process?
It's actually got a screenplay. Columbia Motion Pictures bought Plum Island and the Lions game.
Okay.
They bought it, I believe, for Mace Neufeld, who was a producer who's done all the Clancy books. He did Red October and everything. And Mace is supposed to develop these two books, and Plum Island is kind of on the back burner, but Lion's Game is about terrorism, and it's contemporary now, as contemporary as when I wrote it, is in the, I guess what they call the screenplay stage there.
Yeah. And what about the, what about Upcountry, the, with After the General's Daughter, what's the status of that film?
Yeah, General's Daughter was done by Paramount Motion Pictures. Also, it was Mace Neufeld that produced that one, and that was the one with John Travolta. And Paramount also bought Upcountry. It's the same character, Paul Brenner, who's a Army criminal investigator. And General's Daughter did very well for them. It was the fifth or sixth highest-grossing movie of that year that it came out. So they're anxious to bring back the character of Paul Brenner, who was played by John Travolta. And that's a development also.
Does Travolta want to do the character again?
You know, he did. And if you remember, this is a 1996-97 movie. And I hate to say it, but I don't think John Travolta's done much since then. So I think he'd like to reprise the role, as they say. And talking to him, but, you know, 8 years have gone by, and the world changes, so I don't know what the status of that is.
Yeah, I can relate to that personally, too, so... I wanted to, just to mention for the listeners that might not be aware of this, Word of Honor was one of your novels that you wrote and was done by TNT. And Don Johnson and Gene Triplehorn were in that, and John Hurd. And I've watched the movie, and I thought it was a very well done movie.
I thought so too. I was a little disappointed that it wasn't going to be a feature film. It was sold to originally to Columbia. I mean, this is all boring. I'm sure a lot of people have these things make the rounds. And then Dino De Laurentiis, who's a friend, bought it from Columbia, and he never got around to developing it, and he in turn sold it to TNT. And when I found out, I said, oh gosh, you know, I really don't want a TV movie. But it turned out to be better than the average movie of the week, and I think a lot of it had to do with Don Johnson did an absolutely magnificent job as the character of Ben Tyson, who was a Vietnam War hero accused of war crimes 20 years after the war, and he's court-martialed for a massacre that was committed 20 years before when he led an infantry platoon. And and the book came out, actually the movie came out about the same time as the other Kerry from Nebraska was having his problems.
Okay.
You know, something that happened to Vietnam. So these things do come back to haunt you, and we just saw this in the last presidential election with some of the stuff from John Kerry's past coming back to haunt him.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that that I find interesting about John Corey, and it's in Nightfall as well, is you really don't have him take a political stance per se. I think you have him describe himself as being kind of an anarchist.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, it seems to me that John Corey is kind of growing up with the rest of us as we go through this period of time we go through with terrorism and fear and not knowing what's going to happen yet. And John Corey seems to he's developing as a man and as a human being. And I'm wondering if he's how you've seen him develop as time has gone on as you've written the novels.
Well, that's a good question. Certainly the times have changed since, you know, John Corey first appeared about 7 years ago. And I think, and you're right, I don't give them any political leanings. The fastest way to turn off your readers is to have a guy who's an ideologue. And we don't know what John Corey's politics are, per se. And he is a little bit of an anarchist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he kind of represents the frustration of a lot of Americans. I'm not getting too deep into it.
Right.
But he also, he's a law and order guy, so we can probably say if he pulled the lever in a voting booth, he might vote Republican. But
yeah.
If there was an anarchist ticket, I think he would punch that ticket instead. And, this is kind of new for me to do a continuing series character. So, yeah, when, as along, and as the years pass, and as the author grows up a little bit, and the character grows up a little bit too, and the world changes. And
sure.
What was unthinkable in the first book, Plum Island, which is terrorism in America, becomes more thinkable. And when I wrote Lion's Game, 9/11 hadn't happened yet, but I did mention the World Trade Center bombing of 1993, and there's a lot of foreshadowing there. A lot of people said I was prescient, but I don't think I was so much prescient.
Well, I actually felt the same way, Nelson, because I. One of the things when I was rereading the Lions game, I kind of had to flip back and look at the copyright date a couple times because in one of the scenes, Corey says that they would not go back to the World Trade Center again because these type of people never go back to the scene of the crime, and you pointed out that the JFK was a security nightmare at the time.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And yeah, that was the other thing, too. I got a lot of fan letters after 9/11 that people read Lions Game, said I was kind of exploiting, terrorism at 9/11. But you went back to the copyright. A lot of readers don't. That thing was written 2 years before 9/11, and it sounded contemporary after 9/11. I'm glad it did. I was, I'm happy when it actually happened. But we do mention terrorism in America and the possibility of a second attack on the World Trade Center in that book that was written 2 years before.
Well, if it's published in 2000, it means you probably wrote it in like 98, 99, so.
Actually, it was published in 2000, written 98, 99, and the paperback was out when 9/11 happened, and I think that's why I got a lot of response. People don't know the publishing business, but it was some kind of a quirky book or something put out to take advantage of the events of 9/11, but actually it was written about 2 years before.
Yeah. Well, that's short-sighted on people's point of view, but that doesn't necessarily surprise me. With publication of Nightfall and with the focus on the tragedy with the airline, what do you think the public response is going to be, or how do you see this book as being perceived? With some of the ideas that John Corey has about perhaps how this plane actually was destroyed.
Yeah, that's a good question. This is the first time I've ever based the book almost entirely on a true incident. And the true incident here is the crash of TWA Flight 800 on July 17, 1996, off the Atlantic coast of Long Island. And I knew people who actually witnessed the crash. And while I was researching Lion's Game, I was talking to a lot of people from the Joint Terrorist Task Force that actually worked the TWA case. And there was a lot of evidence. I mean, there was a lot of eyewitnesses who, over 200 eyewitnesses actually saw a streak of light that they described sort of like a rocket or a missile rising from the ocean going toward the plane, and the plane exploded. So initially, and I live on Long Island, I was out in the east end of Long Island that night when it happened, and initially everybody thought it was a terrorist attack, although a lot of people just couldn't believe it because this is, again, before 9/11, and so people said, is it possible a terrorist could have fired a surface-to-air missile and blown up a 747? The forensic evidence suggested that it was a accidental explosion of the center fuel tank, and that was inconclusive. It was strong evidence that the center fuel tank exploded by itself because of a spark. And that would have been the end of it, except that there were still those 200 witnesses, eyewitnesses. And there were 900 witnesses to the explosion itself, because it was the South Shore of Long Island, as a recreational area, and it was summertime. But other 900 witnesses, 200 described to FBI interviewers the streak of light that hit that went up toward the plane, and the plane exploded. And the FBI just couldn't explain that one away. So, you have this kind of disconnect between what people saw, 200 people saw, and what the government said. And I guess, into that gap, into that disconnect, came my book. And I think the best I could hope for is that it might reopen the investigation.
Good, good. And I think if people will have the patience and read the book all the way through, I think there's a very satisfying emotional payoff to this. That really the answer to some of the questions maybe that people are obsessed about when they're reading the book end up not being as important as the world we live in today. That things have changed, and I found the story totally believable and very emotionally satisfying. Now, Nelson, you say the book you're working on now is not a John Corey novel. That's correct.
That's correct. Yeah. What I'm working on now, actually untitled at the moment, but it is a terrorist book, and you know, I think a lot of contemporary novelists, if not all contemporary novelists, write about the times they live in.
Mm-hmm.
And I began my career doing some Cold War stuff. The Cold War is over, so you kind of move on. And it's a terrorist plot against America. And it sounds like every other book we've ever heard, but heard of coming down the pike in the bestseller list. But it's a little bit different. I mean, I hope it's different. And it's not John Corey. It's certainly a book that I could have plugged John Corey into very easily because he does work for the Anti-Terrorist Task Force. But I've done something different in this book. I've created a CIA character who's actually the hero. We don't see too many CIA characters.
No, you don't.
And because, again, Casey, times change. In the 60s, during the James Bond era, during the Kennedy administration, the CIA were heroes. And then somewhere along the line, they became not heroes. And I'm going to bring back a CIA guy who is very, very much a James Bond. James Bond, of course, was MI5, his British intelligence.
Right.
American version of and kind of recreating the CIA hero of the early 60s before the Vietnam War.
Okay.
If the time is right for that, I think people would like to believe the CIA is perhaps not as inept as the media makes them out. And I'm looking for a different kind of hero, and it's funny that to find something different, you got to go back to the recent past, which is not so recent, actually. It's about 40 years. So we got a CIA guy who's a hero in this book. And
Good. One of the things that I think you've been able to do, Nelson, that not a lot of novelists have been able to do, you began your career writing about Vietnam, and a lot of people in the Cold War, and a lot of people have not been able to make the transition into the modern world we live in, whether it be terrorism or just the changing political tide we find ourselves in. And I think some authors have kind of lost their voice after writing a book or two about Vietnam. And you've been able to maintain your ability to write about these things. And has it been a challenge at times to try to figure out where I want to go with the next book?
Yeah, it really has been a challenge. And you're right, I do different books. I don't write the same novel every time, like some authors I can name, but with line names.
Right.
My heroes are usually different, and sometimes I use the same hero, well, only twice in the case of John Corey and Paul Brenner from The General's Daughter, but a lot of the Cold War authors found themselves unemployed after the Cold War ended, and they couldn't make the transition, and I think it's a matter of it's like doing the term paper. I mean, you might not be interested in anthropology, but you got to do the term paper. So that's the course you took, and you do your research. And you have to have some interest in it, too. And I didn't really want to do another terrorist book, but I just found the whole thing absolutely fascinating and also absolutely frightening. And that's why I'm doing this one. And so this is kind of like two terrorist books in a row, which is unusual for me, because I like to skip around between murder mysteries. One of my books, Gold Coast, is more of a... it was more of like a Great Gatsby. It was a little bit literary and a little bit more of a love story. So I do skip around. My readers either love it or my readers are very frustrated by it. And that keeps me entertained because I can't write the same book every time. So I've got to write something that interests me so I can. If I'm interested in the book, then the reader's going to be interested.
Yeah. One book I'd like to mention is The Charm School, because I think that's... most authors, I think they write perhaps two, three, or four what I would consider true works of literature, and I think The Charm School falls into that category. I've read the book several times, and I find it just a fascinating concept that you came up with. And when I mentioned your name to people, The Charm School still is mentioned quite frequently as one of the favorite novels that people have that they enjoy reading.
Yeah, it was, I enjoyed the Cold War thrillers. I mean, I read them myself. That was my recreational reading. I hadn't really sat down and written one until I sat down to write The Charm School. And, I mean, ironically, it came out right at the end of the Cold War, right before the wall came down. And that was my first and last Cold War novel. But it was a fascinating time, and I think we kind of forget. We forgot very quickly as Americans. You forget everything. The period that we lived through during the Cold War. And I know that I get letters from professors who say they use Charm School for the younger students as required reading for, although it's fiction, use it as required reading for courses about the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
The book lives on long after the Cold War is over.
And I know haven't you just recently sold the film rights to The Charm School again, or is someone seriously looking at it again?
Yeah, we did. This book has been optioned so many times I could probably retire down in Tahiti with the option money.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that, right? But now it's with Crusader Films, and they are co-producing with Paramount.
Okay.
And Billy Friedkin, who made The French Connection.
Sure.
And so it looks like it's going to be a go, and if it's a go, it's going to be unusual for Hollywood. If you think about it, since Red October, there really hasn't been a major or maybe even any good Cold War story to come out of Hollywood. They kind of forgot about the Cold War and this whole mining World War II, and that period in between has become a dead period for Hollywood. But they want to try bringing back, the Cold War story, and I think it'd be interesting if they actually go ahead with it.
I do too, and if they and I hope they stay true to the story.
Hope so.
And it could end up being a fabulous film. With Nightfall, Nelson, what's the thing you're happiest about Nightfall, would you say? One of the things I enjoy is that in a lot of series characters, I use that rather loosely because you can kind of pigeonhole things with that, but I think the relationship with John Corey and Kate Mayfield is turned into a very interesting relationship, and I think that's one of the highlights of Nightfall is the John Corey, this man who started out in Plum Island and in the Lions game, who had kind of a life of his own and was very independent, has now become kind of dependent on Kate Mayfield and really respects her opinion. And was that one of your goals with Nightfall, was to develop their relationship?
Well, the thing was, it's after Lions Game, at the end of Lions Game, I won't give away the ending.
Right.
He doesn't marry Kate Mayfield, which is his partner. She's an FBI lady, and he works with her. And again, every one of these books was supposed to be the last, and I said, well, that's the end of John Corey. He's married now, and nobody really cares much about a married hero.
Right.
And that was one of the reasons why the publisher, my agent, myself, really seriously considering not bringing back John Corey, because we left him married, and she was inconvenient, for a character who's kind of a romantic character in many ways, to be married and happily married.
Mm-hmm.
Is a little bit of a challenge, a little bit of a hindrance. And we thought about knocking her off in chapter one, so Corey, but then, of course, he would be obviously depressed and very, very lonely. Usually when you have these characters who are so tortured, their wives have died 10 years before, so they're still they're able to function. So whereas his partner again and married was difficult, and I'm not being cynical about marriage, it's just that it's not quite as sexy as a single guy or a single woman. It was a real challenge, but I think I made it a plus. They have a good marriage. They're very independent, and at the same time, I think in love. And what could have been a plot problem with the book turned out to be, I think, maybe an asset.
Yeah, I agree. What about Ted Nash? He's a character that has appeared in all three of the John Corey novels, and talk to me, if you would, just a little bit about Ted Nash and his relationship with John Corey.
Yeah, I mean, Ted Nash is a CIA man, and we meet him first in Plum Island, and he and Corey hate each other immediately, and for visceral reasons. I mean, there's not any logical reason why they should hate each other, except that they're opposite. I mean, Ted Nash is a Yale graduate, CIA, very suave, sophisticated, and John Corey is very much the opposite, and But he was such a great villainous character that I won't give too much away.
No.
Comes a continuing character in the book, and he's kind of like, you know, a lot of my books don't have villains per se.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the system, but so you kind of need an on-stage villain, and I think Ted Nash represents all the conspiracy theories that the government is up to something.
Yeah.
And the CIA is always a good foil for that kind of a plot angle.
Exactly. Excellent. I wanted to, just briefly, I wanted to tell you I thought that the best mystery stories of 2004, who Otto Penzler is the series editor, and you were the guest editor this year, I thought it was a wonderful collection of stories.
It really was, and you know, Otto called a lot of them for me, and Otto's an old friend, and he's a giant in the publishing business, and you know him, and he's, when next time we talk to him at home, he still owes me money for being the guest editor. He hasn't paid me yet.
He hasn't paid you yet? Well, I'm going to be seeing him on Monday or Tuesday, so I'll remind him of that. And then don't you have another, isn't there, a Dangerous Women coming out?
Yeah, I have a story I wrote for Otto in an anthology called Dangerous Women. It was, and they were mystery stories, and had just something a little bit different. It is about a dangerous woman, and but it's not so much a murder mystery as it is a little bit of a kind of a Vietnam story. I was in Vietnam in '68, and it's about a female sniper.
Oh, good.
Dangerous woman, and she's picking off an American patrol, you know, man at a time. So it didn't really fit into the requirements that Otto gave me that it had to be a murder mystery, but it kind of fits.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good. Well, Nelson, I really appreciate the time you've given me today. You've been very generous with your time, and I wish you nothing but the best of success with Nightfall. I'm sure it's going to be a bestseller, and I look forward to... you have two books remaining on the Time Warner contract, is that correct?
I do. The one I'm working on now, and then the final John Corey book.
Yeah. And I hope you decide to keep writing after that, but I would certainly understand if you decided to take a break. You've certainly earned it.
Thank you.